Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
The numbers are so familiar. Almost 5,000 lives, 19 hijackers, 4 airplanes and 2 towers brought down in one autumn morning. The images and stories of tragedy and terrorism, shock and survival, hatred and heroism have been permanently sewn into the fabric of the nation. And the phrase, "everything has changed," continues to echo across its canyons, prairies, cities and suburbs. Since this program began on the 17th of September, we've tried to document that changing America through your voices in a series of radio diaries. We ask listeners of this program to send in their own stories, their personal reflections, and collectively, you've added immeasurable depth and perspective to our exploration. Tonight, we listen back to your diaries, to American voices from this strangest of seasons. We begin with diaries from those first days immediately following the hijackings when the emotions, the fear, the horror, the shock were still so raw. First, a diary from one of our producers here at the program. Nate DeMeo lives in Providence, Rhode Island. On September 11th, he was among the many reporters sent to New York to cover what everyone knew would be one of the biggest news stories of our lives.
On the day that everyone was trying to get out of New York, we were trying to get in. We were sent to cover the story. In the car, on the way from Providence, my colleague Jill was on her cell phone, trying to figure out which roads were closed. She asked me why I agreed to go. I have limited reporting experience. I've covered a cricket match, a couple of court hearings, and a ballroom dancing championship. I told her I agreed to go so I could do the good work of which I hoped I was capable. And I told her I needed to know that this tragedy was real. From my desk at the NPR station in Providence, talking to Expert X about Subject Y, or from my couch, watching TV, or from my bed, reading with my new glasses before I go to sleep, I'm often struck by what seems to be the near impossibility of connecting with a sense of the real. A sense of really getting it, of really understanding that the people I read about or whose lives I hear about on the radio or see on TV are real people. How do you understand from your home in America or anywhere that the Palestinian man in the news struck by a rubber bullet is a real person? How can I even begin to comprehend the horror, the true unspeakable horror of the slaughter of 800,000 Rwandans, or have any contact with the material reality of a real machete cutting off the real hand of a real boy in Sierra Leone? Or the real grief of a real widower who has lost a wife in a tornado, or a flood, or on a roller coaster. How can you know that from your couch watching the news, or from your car listening to the radio in the Taco Bell drive-thru? But there are times, for whatever reason, when you get it, when you're sufficiently staggered by the staggering and humbled by that which is beyond any life you've ever known. Maybe someone in your life has died, or maybe someone's gotten married, and clarity cuts through the whir and sputter of the everyday. I had spent the week before last Tuesday falling in love. On Saturday night, I had fallen asleep in a bed with white sheets that shone blue in the moonlight in the Hollywood Hills with a woman I couldn't believe I had to leave the next morning. And on Tuesday evening, I was driving up through Queens watching the sunset and a plume of smoke because the goddamn city of New York was on fire. A lot of friends have said to me in the last few days that they feel they need to be in New York to make any sense of this. That from where they sit in Providence or Chicago or Brussels, it just seems surreal. And it's sad to tell them that seeing it probably wouldn't change that. On Tuesday night, it was in Brooklyn. We couldn't get into Manhattan. I was sitting in a bar with the best friend I have. He's a friend from high school that lives in the Greenpoint neighborhood of the Brooklyn-Queens line. We were a half mile away, if that. Step outside and you could smell the smoke. But it could have been London or Tokyo or Sydney or Kuala Lumpur. It felt no more real to be there. It made no sense to be sitting there. It's a 20-minute cab ride to the Trade Center on a normal day if the lights turn in your favor from where we were in the bar. And to know that there are firefighters breathing in asbestos just over the river, and that there is surely a survivor somewhere in there with his legs crushed under a wall of concrete, but is still alive for the time being, and that somewhere in Rye, New York, or Metuchen, New Jersey, there's a kid who will never see their mother again because the steel beams that hold up the building she works in have melted, actually melted. It made no sense, and it makes no sense now. I talked to my girlfriend that night. She'd been watching her hometown burn from 3,000 miles away. I told her I was frightened by the prospect of having to make sense of this for people. How could I begin to make rational the inherently irrational? How could I begin to make solid all that had so quickly melted into air? It was daunting, and it's daunting right now. She reminded me that people just want to know what it looks like and what it smells like and what it sounds like, and that that might be enough. These are a couple of things I saw and heard. At checkpoints at major intersections, the police would only let you pass if you presented a photo ID. On First Avenue in Houston, my Rhode Island license got me through just fine. A Chinese woman trying to get to work showed a photo ID. The cop told her she wouldn't be able to pass without proof of citizenship. I don't know how being a Rhode Islander prevents me from being a security threat.
Any type of valid ID? Driver's license?
I think this is very good. I have to take a citizenship and go to put.
Bring me your citizenship papers.
But I don't have copy.
In Union Square, a man came up to me with whiskey on his breath. He said his brother was a fireman and had died that morning. He was already sick of people talking about God's will. He got into a shouting match with a man claiming it was time to turn to Jesus. From the other end of the park, you could hear drumming. I walked over thinking it was, frankly, hippies or Krishnas. It wasn't. It was an African-American family. A dad in his 30s playing the guitar, a daughter maybe 8 years old, in cornrows and a toothpaste commercial smile playing a drum. A 5-year-old boy on the tambourine, and 2 kids even younger trying to sit still. They were playing pop songs. In times like this, it seems that the simplest things take on grand implications. A cool breeze is somehow cooler, a loved one somehow more dear, and a pop song somehow profound. 2 days ago, I had a day off. I was in Providence running errands. I was in a drugstore. I was waiting in line to pay for an eyeglass repair kit, 2 light bulbs, and a Coke. There was a machine that develops your photos in 1 hour or less. As I stood in line, I watched pictures of someone's vacation passing through the machine. The people in the pictures were happy then.
Nate DeMayo lives in Providence, Rhode Island. As the nation struggled to understand the events of September 11th, teachers across the country had to answer tough questions from their students. Cami Patrizio teaches 8th grade in Lower Manhattan. She spoke of trying to answer those questions while she still had so many of her own.
When our school director came into my classroom at 10:30 a.m. on September 11th, I was in the middle of a math lesson with my 8th graders. She told me, "We've been attacked. The World Trade Center is a pile of rubble. The Pentagon has been hit. We think there are going to be more. We don't know who did it. Parents are coming in to pick up their children. Let them go." I nodded, slack-jawed, turned to the unaware class, and continued with my lesson. 15 minutes later, halfway through a sentence, the magnitude of the event registered in the recesses of my brain. I shut down mentally. "That's all for today," I said to the class, their confused faces blithely unaware of the morning's events. I stepped into the hallway and flagged down our dean of students. "Do you want me to tell them?" I asked, and was glad when she told me that she would be visiting each classroom during the next period to deliver the news. I didn't know what I would say to them. How do you tell a group of 13-year-olds from New York City that unknown assailants had destroyed their city's 2 largest buildings? The idea of the World Trade Center lying in ruins evaded my comprehension. What would it mean to them? I monitored the hallways during the next hour, directing parents to classrooms and comforting students. I watched our school director put her hand on a crying child's shoulder. "Don't worry, sweetheart. You're in the safest place that you could be right now. Go back to class." I shuddered. A plane swept loudly over our school. I locked eyes with another teacher in the hallway. Was it theirs or ours? And who were they? Were our families and friends safe? Would there be more attacks? How long would we be asked to remain in the school? We embraced and went on our way. I wonder now how many times that scene played itself out in New York City classrooms that day, as courageous teachers and administrators put their fears aside to do what they do best, care for our city's children. Amazingly, our teachers continued to teach, and the class discussions were amazing. "But what can we do?" one stunned humanities teacher asked. The question is indicative of her own need to make sense of the situation as much as it was an attempt to focus the bubbling student discourse. "I think we should find out who they are and sit down to talk to them," said Sergio, an extremely energetic 8th grader. "I don't think that we should fight them right away. That doesn't solve anything. We should talk to them and find another solution to the problem." They were words straight out of our school's conflict resolution curriculum. One of my students, Alex, a wizard with computers who has a dry sense of humor far beyond his 13 years, was the information lifeline at our small alternative school on Manhattan's Lower East Side. He monitored the global and travel updates stoically on his portable radio. All of the number and some of the letter trains are running in Manhattan. The ferries are running, but only to carry the bodies over to Jersey. His matter-of-fact tone made the whole nightmare more unbelievable. One of my students was talking about carrying bodies across the river on the boat that I take to work every day. What were the implications for their lives? Many of their homes are less than 20 blocks away from Ground Zero. Their pain often manifests itself as anger towards countries, faceless terrorists, and each other. Just yesterday, one of my students, a bright, quiet boy, became so frustrated with another student's standard adolescent jibes that he punched a brick wall and broke his hand. His father worked in World Trade Center Building 7. They ache, as we all ache, for the loss of lives and the uncertainty of the days that lie ahead. They now see bullet holes and graffiti in local storefront windows owned by Americans of Middle Eastern descent. They bear witness to the hate crimes in their neighborhoods. Their words and artwork sing of their search for peace, pictures of planes embedded in flame-engulfed buildings and bodies falling from the sky punctuate our school's memorial wall. I marvel, incredulous at their desire to move forward and make change, inspired by their capacity to care in the face of such tremendous grieving. To the victims of the World Trade Center, wrote one student, rest in peace. We will not forget you. We love you.
Kemi Patrizio lives in Manhattan. While the TV cameras were trained on the incredible drama of New York City, it was nearly forgotten that the people of Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C. were grieving their own dead and dealing with their own catastrophes. Bill Shore is executive director of Share Our Strength, a nonprofit organization based in the Washington area that fights hunger. As Bill volunteered at the rescue effort at the Pentagon, he found that in the face of such enormous tragedy, we cling to whatever good we can do, no matter how small.
At the Pentagon South parking lot, the smoke has cleared, but not the acrid smell. From where I stand, at the very base of the building, the men walking and working on its roof seem small, like miniature toy soldiers. The building is that massive. Cranes pick at its gash like vultures tearing into a wound. There's no running and shouting anymore. Instead, the parking lot that surrounds the Pentagon looks like the site of a convention or public safety flea market. Tents have been erected. Salvation Army and Red Cross vehicles bearing license plates from Virginia, Maryland, North and South Carolina, Texas and Tennessee, and a dozen other states are parked side by side with local ambulances. A mobile McDonald's has been erected, complete with golden arches. Enough Gatorade has been stacked on pallets to quench the thirst of the entire armed forces. Volunteers resting on folding chairs find shade and share stories, exchanging business cards. It is possible to forget that 180 bodies have lain trapped beneath the rubble just yards away, but not for long. I came to perform the smallest of chores, hauling 500 pounds of charcoal briquettes from the back of my Jeep to the huge grill constructed by our friends at Tyson Foods. The plant manager, who supervises 600 employees at their Berlin, Maryland factory, brought his team members and an 18-wheeler loaded with chicken. They are going through more than 8,000 pounds of chicken a day, feeding as many as 2,500 rescuers and volunteers. Share Our Strength facilitated their participation here, though nothing could have kept them away. When they run over to express their gratitude for having some role to play, I know just how they feel. Military might alone cannot make a nation strong. It can only protect the strengths already existing within. The fact that our national leaders will be almost exclusively focused on achieving victory over foreign adversaries makes our work to make a difference here at home not less relevant, but more so. Beyond managing grief, the toughest challenge for those of us who are not firemen, doctors, or iron workers has been finding a way to help. Against a catastrophe of this scale, it's almost impossible to do anything that feels significant. So the small things count. I stack the briquettes with extra care.
Bill Shore lives in Silver Spring, Maryland. We're going to take a short break and continue with this special edition of our show. When we return, Americans look for answers and try to figure out what normal means in this new America. To read transcripts of the radio diaries that you've heard tonight or to listen to other diaries, visit our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, we're listening back to radio diaries that have aired on our program since it began 2 months ago. In this section of our show tonight, we hear from Americans trying to figure out how to respond to the attacks of the 11th and how to return to the day-to-day concerns and rituals of ordinary life. Filmmaker Michael Moore was scheduled to fly on September 11th. Like thousands of Americans, when the FAA grounded all commercial flights, he and his wife rented a car and began the long drive home. On the road from Los Angeles to New York, Michael Moore recorded his thoughts along the way. Here's the first entry in that diary.
Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. Dear friends, I was supposed to fly today on the 4:30 p.m. American Airlines flight from Los Angeles to JFK. But tonight I find myself stuck in L.A. with an incredible range of emotions over what has happened on the island where I work and live in New York City. My wife and I spent the first hours of the day after being awakened by phone calls from our parents at 6:40 a.m. Pacific time, trying to contact our daughter at school in New York and our friend Joanne, who works near the World Trade Center. I called Joanne at her office. As someone picked up, the first tower exploded, and I could hear it in the background, and the person answering the phone screamed and ran out, leaving me no clue as to whether or not she or Joanne would live. It was a sick, horrible, frightening day. On December 27th, 1985, I found myself caught in the middle of a terrorist incident at the Vienna airport. It left 30 people dead, both there and at the Rome airport. The machine gunning of passengers in each city was timed to occur at the same moment. I do not feel like discussing that event tonight because it still brings up too much despair and confusion as to how and why I got to live. A fluke, a mistake, a few feet on the tarmac, and I'm still here, there but for the grace of God or whoever. Safe, secure. I'm an American, living in America. I like my illusions. I walk through a metal detector, I put my carry-ons through an X-ray machine, and I know all will be well. Here's a short list of my experiences lately at airport security. At the Newark airport, the plane is late at boarding everyone. The counter can't find my seat, so I'm told to just go ahead and get on, without a ticket. At the Detroit Metro airport, I don't want to put the lunch I just bought at the deli through the X-ray machine, so as I pass through the metal detector, I hand the sack to the guard through the space between the detector and the X-ray machine. I tell him, it's just a sandwich. He believes me and doesn't bother to check. The sack has gone through neither security device. At LaGuardia, New York, I check a piece of luggage, but decide to catch a later plane. The first plane leaves without me, but with my bag. No one knowing what is in it. I have brought knives, razors, and once my traveling companion brought a hammer and chisel. We were on the way to the Berlin Wall back in 1989. No one stopped us. Of course, I have gotten away with all this because the airlines consider my safety so important, they pay rent-a-cops $5.75 an hour to make sure the bad guys don't get on my plane. That's what my life is worth, less than the cost of an oil change. Too harsh, you say? Well, chew on this. A first-year pilot on American Eagle, the commuter arm of American Airlines, receives between $15,000 and $17,000 a year in annual pay. That's right, $15,000 to $17,000 for the person who has your life in his hands. There was one guy, an American Eagle pilot, who had four kids, so he went down to the welfare office and applied for food stamps, and he was eligible. Someone on welfare is flying my plane? Is this for real? You're telling me that the person flying the plane makes less than the kid down at Taco Bell? So spare me the talk about all the precautions the airlines and the FAA is now taking. They, like all businesses, are concerned about one thing, the bottom line and the profit margin. Four teams of 3 to 5 people each were able to penetrate airport security on the same morning at three different airports and pull off this heinous act? My only response is, that's all? Well, the pundits are in full diarrhea mode, gushing on about the terrorist threat and today's scariest dude on the planet, Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden. You know, what I want to know is that why is it all day long I've heard everything about this guy except for one fact? We created the monster known as Osama bin Laden. Where did he go to terrorist school? At the CIA. Oh, don't take my word for it. I saw a piece on MSNBC last year that laid it all out for you. When the Soviet Union occupied Afghanistan, the CIA trained him and his buddies in how to commit acts of terrorism against the Soviet forces. And it worked. The Soviets turned and ran. Bin Laden was grateful for what we taught him and thought it might be fun to use those same techniques against us. Of course, our last big domestic terrorism bombing on our soil was not conducted by a guy from the desert, but rather by our own citizens, a couple of ex-military guys who hated the federal government and went and rented a Ryder truck. Maybe it's because the Arabs are just that much better of a foil for us. A key ingredient in getting Americans whipped into a frenzy against this new enemy is the all-important race card. It's much easier to get us to hate when the object of our hatred doesn't look like us. Congressmen and senators spent the day calling for more money for the military. One senator on CNN even said that he didn't want to hear any more talk about more money for education or health care. We should have only one priority, our self-defense. Will we ever get to the point where we realize that we will be more secure when the rest of the world isn't living in poverty so we can have nice running shoes? So let us mourn and let us grieve. And when it's appropriate, let's examine our contribution to this unsafe world in which we live. It doesn't have to be like this.
Michael Moore lives in New York City. In the weeks that followed the attacks, many Americans, like Michael Moore, staked out positions as the nation debated how to respond to the attacks. For Alexandra Wolf, a student at Duke University, the responses of some of the liberal voices on campus were not what she wanted to hear in the time of crisis.
Class begins and the voice from the front of the room says, "We only got what we deserved. We've been bombing and invading other countries at will." In a seminar, a student says, "The level of patriotism in America is scary." As two students enter a classroom, I hear one say to the other, "The most horrible part of this whole thing is all the racial profiling." I hear others saying, "You have to separate the political from the personal," and I get sick of all the sob stories. It's comments like these that make it harder for me, a native New Yorker, to face this tragedy from Durham. College campuses are probably the most liberal, politically correct havens in America, and here at Duke, the PC response to the attack is rampant. Such sentiments and others on the college board are the result of a liberal education gone awry. While I, like many other students, fear the idea of World War III and flinch at even the suggestion of genocide, I just can't get my mind around the idea that we deserve the attack, or that the horror of it all is racial profiling. I can't get my mind around the idea that the level of patriotism is scary, referring no doubt to such things as the flags painted on the benches and the red, white, and blue decorating every storefront and restaurant. If this display of unity in the face of attack is frightening, I urge these PC sheep to go back to the roots of their political correctness and ask themselves, if my brother died last Tuesday, would I be the one saying we got what we deserved and we have to separate the political from the personal? If anything is scary inside Duke's cozy nest, it's the wave of fashionable self-loathing. I particularly resent that it's fashionable to complain that one has had a belly full of the sob stories. I spent a good portion of last Wednesday and Thursday talking to high school friends who've lost their parents. I spoke to one friend's mother whose husband has undoubtedly perished. Yet she still whispered into the phone in a hoarse, tremulous voice, "We're going to find him. I know he made it out. He's one of the most resourceful men you can imagine. I'm on the internet right now looking at the survivor lists." I did not talk to a 23-year-old girl I grew up with and met for dinner just 3 weeks ago. The attack on the World Trade Center either incinerated her or blew her to bits. She no longer exists. Am I being advised to separate the political from the personal in order to trumpet the fashionable liberal slant? A minister at the prayer service at the university last Wednesday told the audience to pray that the government remains peaceful and doesn't attack anyone else. Although we've all been brought up wanting world peace, I will not pray for pacifism. I'll pray against it. As a 5'5" female English major and French minor, I hardly have the mindset of a warlord. But I will wear my red, white, and blue. I will revere our flag flowing in the wind and hold in contempt the terrorists who attacked the wrong country. Believe whatever you want, coward our patriotism, But unless you have a close friend with a father who drove her to school every morning and tucked her in at night, and whose day was interrupted by a 757 smashing into his office, driving temperatures up to 1,500 degrees, and hurling him and his coworkers out through the walls, just don't tell me about your political correctness. I won't be listening.
Alexandra Wolf lives in Durham, North Carolina. While public debates about policies, strategy, and blame raged in the media, people were trying to figure out how to work through the shock and the loss in their own households. Like so many parents, Zoe Clark West struggled to figure out what her young child needed to understand about what had happened in the world of adults.
Exactly 1 week after the terrorist attack on the United States, a coworker asked me how my son was doing in the wake of the week's tragic events. For the first time, I realized how well my son was doing, and how well, because of him, I was doing. This is not to say that I hadn't cried, that I hadn't felt hopelessly afraid and desperately furious at times. On that fateful Tuesday, my office was shut down, and I rushed to my son's school alongside many worried parents. There are moments when time can almost stop. You get stuck in a thought or a feeling, and choose not to eat or sleep, but just let your mind wander through the ever-changing and unending pieces of the world. This can be frightening, as can losing track of the parts of our daily routines that make our individual worlds go round. As I listen to my coworkers, to friends, to people on the radio, many of them seem to be lost in this no-time land. Their days are made up of news coverage, special reports, little eating, and less sleep. It is as if the larger world has swallowed up their own and sucked the life right out of them. A child, however, will pull you back to the reality of lost shoes, band-aids, underwear jokes, and snacks. When my husband and I watched some of the news coverage of the terrorist attack and talked with him about it, even though those images cut the world open for him, with his parents framing and explaining what he saw that day, the world was still contained in the simple idea that sometimes people choose to do very mean things, and we don't know why. But in our family, we don't choose to do mean things, and we are safe, and we love each other. Some people will undoubtedly feel that I am fooling my child or myself or both of us. I certainly felt the same way 12 years ago when my aunt carefully circumnavigated a question from her young daughter about a child who had been brutally murdered. Why would you keep the truth from her? I wondered self-righteously. But now it seems far more likely that the truth is that a 5-year-old doesn't need the truth a 12-year-old or a 17-year-old or a 25-year-old does. I am not naive. I do not think the task ahead of our nation an easy one. But in this instance, I think the guileless acknowledgement of my son that something terrible happened, a desire to help those who were hurt, and the number one rule of first grade, which is be kind, are far more positive responses than the vindictive and irresponsible tossing around of words like righteousness and war. In every age, there is always some time of great suffering. But those who are loved and feel safe and secure in the world of their childhood will carry the larger world forward through those times with compassion, wisdom, courage, and hope. So it is that I am doing well, well enough, that is, in the wake of so terrible events, that when my son sees that I'm sad, he can hug me and ask me why, and I can tell him that sometimes very sad things happen. And feeling his tender hands on my face, I can let him feel sad with me, while in my sorrowing heart, a sweetness swells due to the goodness that is his world.
Zoe Clark West lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The message from Washington during September and October was that Americans needed to get on with their normal lives. But there were some rituals that were impossible not to view through the lens of September 11th. Gail Pryor's radio diary spoke of a Halloween turned on its head by the specter of real malevolence.
Every October, my sons begin making their plans for Halloween. I eavesdrop from the driver's seat to their discussions, to the planning board meetings held in the back of our minivan. Okay, says my 10-year-old. How about this year? We have screaming spiders that drop down on top of people from the trees. Good idea, concurs my 14-year-old. But let's talk about the dummy. Yeah, shouts the 4-year-old. Let's make it all bloody. Every year, my husband and sons rake up all the leaves in the front yard, stuff them into an old flannel shirt and my husband's work pants, making a bulgy approximation of a man flat on his back in the middle of our front yard. They then get the Halloween box out of the basement. It's a dusty, sticky assortment of leftover costumes, horrible rubber masks, fake fur, fake fangs, and fake blood, and a ball of white, gauzy, synthetic cobwebs with last year's leaves still caught in it. The boys dig out a mask and a wig to make the dummy's head and stick some hiking boots on the end of its legs. Each year, with my husband's help, under his expert and enthusiastic leadership, they create a scene involving the dummy. It usually features lots of fake blood and suggests, they hope, that something terribly violent has taken place on our suburban front lawn. I am the mother. It is my job to keep them physically safe and morally safe. Therefore, my part in their Halloween ritual is to say, "This is awful. You cannot do this." And they always respond, with their dad grinning behind them, "Why not?" And I always say, "Just because." I confess this tepid and ineffectual response comes from my own ambivalence toward my self-righteous position. And I've always secretly agreed with them that the whole point of Halloween is to turn the world upside down for just one night. It's such a deliciously pagan holiday. In its candy-coated primitive way, it suggests that their one-day fit of mock badness will chase away any truly bad stuff. It will vaccinate them from bad things, both outside and inside. This year, however, I listened to my son's Halloween planning meetings without any internal ambivalence. There will be no gruesome scene on the front lawn this year. Although, before I can make my traditional, historically unheeded ruling, my husband speaks up. "No, boys," he says. "Not this year." "Why not?" they ask, astonished by their turncoat dad. "Just because," he says quietly. Then I knew there really would be no mock badness, no fake horror on our front lawn. "Because," I tell them, "this year the grown-ups are too tender." The boys nod. They know. So what are my boys learning after September 11th? That there really is truly bad stuff out there, and we can't scare it away with a bloody dummy. What can we do instead? We can face real danger with real courage. We can treat each other with tenderness. We can find ways to laugh at the gallows. And the planning board meetings? They've continued in the back of the minivan. "Okay," says my 10-year-old. "We still make a dummy. But this time, it's an old lady sitting in a rocking chair, and get this, she's reading Playgirl magazine."
Gail Pryor lives in Belmont, Massachusetts. After the break, we'll move away from a changed America and hear radio diaries about a changed Afghanistan. To hear more radio diaries, visit our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. And we want to hear from you. Send your submissions for future diaries by email to special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This hour, we're revisiting some of the radio diaries that have aired on this program in the last 2 months. In this section, we'll hear diaries about the war in Afghanistan. First, an American looks back to the Kabul he knew as a child and talks about his hope for a changed Afghanistan.
"For four wonderful years, I lived at 6,000 feet above sea level. I was in fourth grade when I arrived and had finished seventh grade when our family left for lower altitudes. Some of the people I went to school with had family names that would sound familiar to most Americans. Others had names like Khan and Abdullah and Azim. They were Pakistani, Bengali, Iranian, Jordanian, and Saudi Arabian. And some were Afghan. We all went to school together at the American International School of Kabul. I grew up playing soccer on dusty, hard-packed fields in Afghanistan where the players shouted, laughed, and muttered in more than one language. For 4 years, I rode my bike through many unnamed streets in Kabul. I received my first communion in Kabul from an Italian priest who spoke seven languages fluently and made incredible gnocchi. On the king's birthday, I watched men on horseback playing games of bushkashi with a headless goat. I played on flag football teams and softball teams, and once I played with gunpowder, which we could buy in any bazaar and which could singe my friend's eyebrows. I watched parades as Soviet-built tanks left teeth marks in the summer-warmed asphalt. My summer days were spent on clay tennis courts with my Jimmy Connors T-2000 and lessons with Muzmir, a Pakistani coach who left me with a more reliable backhand than forehand. In the summers, our family would travel into the mountains of Afghanistan. In Bandiamir, I looked out over the bluest pool of water I have ever seen. I rode on horseback through the Hindu Kush Mountains on narrow paths littered with pieces of raw lapis. Some years ago, after Soviet troops had invaded Afghanistan, I drove into Boston with a friend, also an English teacher, to join walkers raising money for Afghan children dismembered by landmines. The bumper sticker on my car at the time read, "Free Afghanistan." Now, after September 11, Afghanistan is in our newscasts and conversations again, and yet once more, Afghanistan needs to be freed from an occupying force. One Afghan writer likens the Taliban, the self-named students of Islam, to the Nazi force that occupied Poland. This time, though, primetime TV shows like The West Wing are helping us out with ways to learn the many lessons of September 11 and, indirectly, more about a land invaded and occupied and depleted and fragmented so many times in its long and troubled history. All this brings me back, finally, to one more memory from growing up in Kabul. In an accident I witnessed in that now distant and peaceful Kabul, an Afghan woman covered from head to toe in the common chadri suddenly froze in the middle of traffic. A VW minibus struck her with a sickening thud, and she crumpled to the road, dead. I was riding in the front seat of that minibus on my way to a picnic in Pagman. We learned later that it was not the first time she had tried to commit suicide by dashing across a road and suddenly stopping in traffic. So many Afghans have fled to refugee camps in the neighboring countries, which continue to back either the Taliban or the anti-Taliban armies. But now all Afghans seem to me as vulnerable and as desperate as that woman. As I remember growing up in Kabul, I pray that we human beings around the world do what we can to silence the bells that toll for victims taken from our country's families and from those overseas by acts of war or terrorism. I pray that we remember, as John Donne once wrote, that any person's death diminishes us all. That we remember how Afghans and Americans alike are paralyzed by bombs, and that we all equally deserve to feel safe in our beds.
Andrew Brescia lives in Peterborough, New Hampshire. As the war in Afghanistan rages on, many in America watch events overseas with a fear of what might lie ahead for young American men and women in the armed forces. The shadow of Vietnam still darkens the view of so many Americans. Robert Master is a doctor and a veteran of Vietnam. For him, the early stages of the war in Afghanistan were all too familiar.
For so many of my generation who went to Vietnam, that war, with its painful lessons, has become the defining event of a lifetime. I am one such Vietnam veteran who has never come to peace about the Vietnam War, and our nation's response in the aftermath of the tragedy of September 11th has only served to unearth some very painful memories long buried over three decades of everyday joys and sorrows of family, work, friends, and just plain living. I went to Vietnam in 1969 as a young, untrained doctor just out of internship, and I was sent to the 101st Airborne Division in Tua Tien Province, where some of the fiercest fighting of the entire war had been occurring. I did not experience the extreme horror and risks of the infantry grunts, but I did experience my share of terror from frequent rocket and mortar attacks, and I bore witness to unspeakable suffering as the war ripped apart the entire fabric of rural Vietnamese society and destroyed so many young Americans who, along with countless Vietnamese, were the victims of a never-ending train of false assumptions. As long as I live, I will carry with me the memories of the forcible relocation of hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese civilians to a world of disease and death in squalid refugee camps. And I will always remember the terrorized, brutalized, killed, maimed, and emotionally crippled young Americans many barely beyond high school age, just like my three draft-day sons today, who were sacrificed on the altar of arrogance and hubris. Maybe I'm completely incapable of seeing the present in any way other than through the lens of Vietnam. But the blank stares of despair, anguish and anger in ill-clad Afghan refugees holding emaciated infants and children in televised images are the very same faces that I encountered over 30 years ago in Vietnam. And the images of destruction are reminders of the most powerful bombing campaign in history that went on all around me. But beyond this, I see unmistakable parallels between the new war in Afghanistan and the war in Vietnam. Today's perceived problem is terrorism. Back then, it was guerrilla insurrection. But both of these problems are really consequences of a complex set of political, social, and economic injustices. Then as now, bombing is supposed to achieve an objective, but it does not. Civilians are not supposed to be killed, but they are. The indigenous population is supposed to support us, but they do not. Then after all of these failed assumptions, we introduce ground forces, at first on a small scale, but eventually with overwhelming military power to control much of the country, and they live a lie. They are told that they are liberators, but they are viewed as occupiers, and over many years they are picked apart spiritually and physically. If those of us who went to Vietnam have any wisdom to impart at this crucial time, I believe it would be this. Beware of any tendency towards arrogance and self-righteousness. Beware of anyone with a strategy to win hearts and minds. Beware of armchair generals who have never experienced the consequences of decisions to send young men into combat. And lastly, listen carefully to the courageous moral and practical positions of the anti-war movement. I realize that many don't want to hear about the experiences or nightmares of an aging Vietnam veteran. But once, not too many years ago, we were blinded by the power of our technology and the certainty of our cause. We must not allow that to happen again.
Robert Master lives in Brookline, Massachusetts. As host of WBUR Special Coverage, I've listened along with you over the last 2 months to these remarkable personal reflections shared with us in this remarkable season. Tonight, I want to respond with a radio diary of my own. It's been a long time since I was in Afghanistan. It was before Osama bin Laden's rise to fame and infamy, before the Taliban, before the Soviet invasion, and I was very young. In those days, though it seems incredible now, you could take an overland bus from India to Europe. It wasn't Greyhound. In the hippie, love train spirit of that time, we called it the Magic Bus. And today it would have to be magic to travel that impassable route across Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Turkey, the Balkans. We took it for granted, of course, in the way that circumstances of the moment are taken for granted. I'd been in India for a year, studying Gandhi and ancient scriptures. My fellow passengers were spiritual seekers and happy global drifters, young Italians smoking opium in the back of the bus, American and Canadian hippies in outlandish outfits from the bazaars of Goa and Kathmandu, an incongruous family of Mormon missionaries. The bus driver was a high-strung cockney with a scarlet headband and hair like a storybook Jesus. We climbed from Islamabad through the tough-as-nails market town of Peshawar, through ever-cooler, higher, harder terrain, into Afghanistan. With each mile, the landscape grew more craggy and forbidding. So did the people. Women gradually disappeared under head-to-toe burqas. Many men carried old rifles, their shoulders draped with bandoliers of ammunition. The Afghan border post was a cluster of tents between peaks in the Khyber Pass that looked straight out of the 10th century. There were goats, open cook fires, money changers, cross-legged on ancient carpets. We sipped tea, enjoyed the wood smoke in the mountain air, enjoyed the idea that we were in Afghanistan. Up the road, in Kabul, there was a thin veneer of modern life, 5- and 6-story buildings at the center of town, young women in pleated skirts, heads uncovered, walking with schoolbooks alongside tradition-draped elders. And for a hungry American coming up from the largely vegetarian India, there was everywhere the intoxicating aroma of barbecued beef, sizzling kebabs on the smoky grills of hundreds of roadside peddlers. A new Canadian friend and I celebrated with a feast in the streets. And a few hours later, I was nearly dead of meat poisoning, losing everything, losing blood. My Canadian friend got me to the U.S. Embassy, now destroyed by Taliban mobs, and then to the public hospital in Kabul, a mud-walled warren of stark, dirt-floored rooms that looked unchanged since the British Raj. I had lost my senses and was soon thrashing and howling on a narrow bed. Suddenly there was a doctor, a syringe of morphine, and the improbable vision of two smiling young women, Afghan candy stripers, student nurses in crisp pink-striped uniforms hovering over me in my delirium, helping to pump my stomach, wiping my brow, and very gently, over the next 2 days, nursing me, an American stranger with nothing but a backpack and human vulnerability, back to health. They were clear-eyed young women, no older than I, smart and cheerful and carefully saving my life. They were surely pushing the bounds of their traditional culture, while other women on the rough wooden benches in the waiting room peered at the world through the dense crochet of hooded robes. For 2 days, these two women, girls really, kept me covered and warm, tended my intravenous feed, washed my clothes and fed me, then got me out, up on my feet, and waved goodbye. The magic bus had waited. That night, near Kandahar, a flash flood from the Hindu Kush covered the smooth U.S.-built highway, drowned our engine, and left us stranded in the desert. Could be many days waiting for parts, the driver said. A fierce sandstorm swept in, and the next morning I woke early. Every sleeping body in the bus was covered with a layer of fine, white Afghan desert. I rubbed my eyes clean, shook my Canadian friend awake to say goodbye, grabbed my pack, climbed off the bus, and hitchhiked away. Restless to go on, to see more, I wandered free through Herat and Tehran and Istanbul, and finally home, to America. Now, all these years later, it's Lower Manhattan that's been covered in a fine white dust. We have grieved and learned to fear for our freedoms. U.S. soldiers fight in Afghanistan. No buses travel from India to Europe. And on Thanksgiving, I find myself thinking of those Afghan girls, my age then and now, if they live, somewhere. History has dealt Afghanistan a wretched hand. Have those two survived it? Did the Taliban knock them down? Or are they Islamic radicals? Are they starving? Are they refugees fleeing oppression or American bombs? Do they remember an American boy whose life they saved when the world was young? They're part of a hard people with a hard history, but I have glimpsed a soft heart inside, and tonight I give thanks for their long-ago kindness, for graciously saving a life, and I pray that one day the smoke will clear and we will find that soft heart again and share with it our own. To hear more Radio Diaries, visit our website at wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. And we want your diaries. Has your life returned to normal? How has the war abroad, the threat of terrorism at home, or the struggling economy affected your life? Send in your submissions to special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy Thanksgiving. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.